newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now, you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new...
Well, you're listening to The Media Project, produced in accordance with social distancing from a number of different places. I'm Rex Smith, editor-at-large of the Times Union in Albany, and I'm speaking to you today from a remote, secure location. Dr. Alan Shartok is here, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio, or there. How are you?
Well, as we speak, I have just finished my four-mile regimen because the rain is coming, and it's the only way to stay healthy. So delighted to be here.
The doctor knows how to stay healthy. This is a good thing. Rosemary Armeo, an investigative journalist and professor, how are you?
I'm good. In contrast, I'm getting ready to eat cake for breakfast.
I love Rosemary's approach. And Judy Patrick, former editor of the Daily Gazette, vice president of the New York Press Association. What course do you take, Judy, to stay healthy?
I do run every day, but I can tell you right now that I'm out of beer, and that is making me think I need to go to the store.
How far do you run?
Some days five, some days four.
That's very good. Mm-hmm. Very good. I approve.
That's a good thing. We're all keeping our distance appropriately. David Gustain, our producer, is in the studio trying to keep us all in line, and we very much appreciate speaking of essential workers, people at WAMC who are actually making it possible for all this programming to continue. Right, Alan?
I make a point of saying that every time I'm on the air. These are the true heroes of a public radio station. You got to have somebody at the board. They are what keep us on the air, and they are remarkable people. Not only that, but our news division has been coming in every day, and that's a lot of people. They keep that place spick and span, but I worry about them too, and they're heroes also.
Yes, there's a lot of talk about this actually in journalism, about the danger that journalists are being put into. We spoke a little bit about it last week, about how our photographers are trying to encourage people they're shooting pictures of to step outside, and how our reporters who cover the state capitol are generally not showing up in person for these events because so much of that is presented by immediate broadcast. Let's say it's live digitally. But it's very difficult when you're trying to assure that people get the information to also assert to reporters you need to stay healthy, you need to protect yourself. It's a fine line, really.
And photographers are especially vulnerable. They are the ones that can't do this remotely. They actually have to go out into the world and take those photographs. And often they're face-to-face with people who are infected with the virus. And one of the issues that newspapers are having is they can't find masks that they needed to protect, because obviously these masks need to go to healthcare workers first, but grocery store clerks as well, people who are out there covering this story or serving the public, they need some protection as well, and that has become an issue.
Absolutely. Well, the question about coverage of COVID-19 is a significant one. There now comes very interesting research, quickly done research by Pew Research Center, looking at how people perceive the virus based upon their main cable news source. That is, they're looking just among people who say their main source for political and election news is MSNBC, CNN, or Fox News.
Let me guess. Can I guess?
Okay, please.
People who listen to Fox because they listen to the president are less likely to take this as seriously as the other two cable channels. Am I wrong?
You are right. Fox viewers are much less likely to have accurate information about this. For example, the question about whether COVID-19 came about naturally, which it did, as opposed to being manufactured in a lab. Two-thirds of MSNBC viewers say, yes, it came about naturally. Only 37% of Fox News viewers have that correct information. CNN is somewhere in the middle. The percentage who say a vaccine is going to be available in a year or more, which scientists say is way out there. 78% of MSNBC viewers say, yep, it's going to be a year or more. Only half of Fox News viewers say that. So,
disease is spreading in rural areas and moving out of the population centers in the east. They will increasingly take it seriously. I've been reading about the outbreak in Chicago, which is horrendous, and it's stemming actually from two family reunions. Groups got together, didn't think there was any danger, and now they're dying as a result. So I suspect that those numbers are going to change drastically in the next few weeks.
I wonder. You may be right, but at this point, 80% of Fox News viewers are saying that the media either greatly or slightly exaggerated the risk. 80% of Fox News viewers think that it's been exaggerated by the media. Only a third of MSNBC viewers say that.
But Fox viewers, aren't they older and they skew more towards the red states where the virus has not had its biggest impact yet? It's when
Correct.
You see people around you getting sick that you say, well, maybe it wasn't so out of whack.
Well, that's one way of looking at it. Another way is obviously that the Republicans in this country and the people who follow Trump have stuck with him assiduously. They have not moved, right, Rosemary? I mean, they literally haven't moved. So
right.
It's not surprising. I'm sure you're right about the idea that, you know, there are some places that it hasn't hit that hard. But I think this is pretty consistent with their adoration of the president.
Pretty interesting editorial in the Wall Street Journal looking at the presidential briefings, which also Fox News runs in toto, and I think people watch them. And it's saying at first his ratings on handling of the crisis were great. He had these daily briefings. He put mm-hmm. the vice president up front. He put doctors out there. He showed he had a team and had begun to take it seriously. And they now are disgusted as well with those briefings, which have devolved into 90-minute long campaign rallies, and it's the feud of the day, and he picks on the press, and it isn't about keeping America safe from the virus anymore. So the Wall Street Journal is saying that they suspect that he's going to lose people because of that performance.
This is Wall Street Journal reporting, right, Rosemary?
It was an editorial.
Really? How remarkable.
Yeah, that's why it's interesting. And it's all written in very nice terms for the president and, you know, gives him the benefit of the doubt on how he's handled it up to now, but really said, you got to do something with these rallies come news conferences, and gave suggestions for it, which, of course, I don't think he'll listen to, but he ought to.
Not only that, but he will attack anyone. As we know, he will attack Fox people who don't do exactly as he says, and he'll pick on them. And I think they'll all understand that most of these folks have up to now stayed with the president when it comes to those kinds of fights.
And if you listen to the daily news briefings, the spin is starting. He's blaming the World Health Organization. And so they're responsible for him not knowing about the virus early enough, so he says. Or he's starting to blame the states for perhaps not acting soon enough. So the spin is starting, and as Fox carries these briefings, as everybody carries these briefings, that spin is getting into people's heads.
You know, my point of view has evolved on this, but news coverage always evolves over time. 2 weeks ago in this program, we talked about these briefings, and I agreed that I thought the media needed to carry them. I've come to believe that they have actually devolved to a point where there is so little journalistic value to them, that they are Trump campaign rallies in a time of coronavirus, that I think it's a mistake for the media to carry them live. That it ought to be something that is reported upon from a distance in the same way that we do other coverage of the president, so that you are not, by your very format, presenting mistakes, lies, untruths that are only harder for the public to get out of their heads.
There is an action in between covering them and not covering them. That is to change the questioning that the media uses instead of letting him have these feuds that he does with them, and instead of letting him berate them. They should keep the focus on what people are interested in. What are you doing right now to help Americans? What happens next? What goes on? Because that's really the news. That will decide whether Trump is reelected again, how he handles this crisis. So to ask questions, for example, like, you know, how do you account for the fact that you didn't pay attention for it? That's like opening up the feud again. The media has a role in what spectacles these have become.
I agree. But what's interesting to me is watching, and I go back and forth between the three channels, as I know you do, you all do. Of course, Fox is carrying it the way he wants them to. But MSNBC the other day had the president on, you know, the whole thing, while CNN did not. Now, that's interesting because we always assume MSNBC is the lefty channel as opposed to CNN. So these decisions are being made ad hoc as they go along.
Well, the last MSNBC one I watched, they would back away from the press briefing when they thought the president was just blathering. CNN was carrying it live, but they had a web link off to the right in the lower right-hand corner of the screen for Facts First, but it was a kind of a useless old link that didn't give you an updated version of the truth or the untruth spoken. So they're trying to handle it in different ways, but breaking away when they think the president is not saying anything useful or truthful is an interesting tactic, but you never know what's going to come out of his mouth next.
It does require real production skills, I would think, on the part of the producers and the director of the show, the person actually calling the shots as it's being aired. If you're going to try to do live fact-checking, you'd have to have your facts lined up that you know the president's going to lie about or misspeak, let's say, to be generous, and be able to actually use the chyron, that's the lower third on the screen, to explain to readers the reality of, to viewers, the reality of what the president's talking about.
Well,
great
to go back to my favorite Wall Street Journal article. They recommend that the president not even show up. Come in once or twice a week to give his imprimatur, but it actually should be Pence running that thing. And if you notice, even the stations that are running the president will back away when Pence comes out. He actually knows more than the president on the details, the questions that they're asking.
Yeah. So is it going to make any difference that there's now a new White House press secretary, Stephanie Grisham, who I couldn't pick out in a crowd, frankly? She's been White House press secretary for, 6 months, is it, or so, has been replaced by Kayleigh McEnany, a former CNN commentator. Is this going to make a difference at all? Do we care?
Okay, well, I'll go first.
No.
Mark Meadows put her in. He knows much more about communication than Stephanie Grisham did. I think she'll be part of a team. She is just horrible on truth, as is her boss. She is completely in tune with Trump, but I think she'll be the face of the administration on the Sunday programs, and Trump will continue to do the press conferences.
Right. All these press secretaries are making Sean Spicer look good. At least I think he tried. He tried to tell the truth, and he cared about telling the truth a little bit. In the early days, there was the idea that, once you tell a falsehood, you know, you lose credibility with us. Now the press is saying nobody has any credibility, and the press secretary doesn't matter at all.
Right. It's hard to believe that the job of White House press secretary has been degraded continually by each incumbent since Sean Spicer. So now here comes Kayleigh McEnany, whom I remember as a CNN commentator being blindly loyal to Trump, but being very slender on facts. Even on, let's say, marshaling selective facts, she's not a person who's given to detail, let's say. But the president is his own press secretary, so I guess it hardly matters much. It's really odd.
Well, Rex, I think the diagnostic question you asked at the beginning was of this little discussion was correct. Should we care? And the answer probably is not.
A press secretary can play a vital role because the press secretary often is interpreting what the president says for the rest of the administration. The press secretary is the person who is in the room as the president is making decisions often. That's certainly what the best press secretaries have been. So they're an authoritative voice, and it helps to keep the administration in line as much as informing the public. But that isn't the way that Donald Trump has treated his press secretaries.
No, and I don't think she's any exception. She came from his campaign staff. She's been in charge of messaging to get him reelected. So I don't think it's a coincidence that now she's in the White House.
And I know this is a fine point, but since she's a federal employee now, doesn't that preclude her from going out and campaigning overtly for him? And I know that Kellyanne Conway has gotten into trouble a few times for that.
Gotten in trouble, but who's going to enforce it? You know, that's the
exactly.
thing. yes, presumably you're not supposed to, under the Hatch Act, as a federal employee, do overt partisan activity, but that's just not how it operates in the White House, is it?
Not this way.
No, that's not reality. No,
but that's an interesting question.
It used
Rex.
To be.
That's an interesting question. If it were the Obama administration and somebody in his area did what these people are doing, would there be a greater portrayal of them as being, you know, and accountability for them under the Hatch Act and the rest? I suspect there would.
I don't know that the media would handle it any differently. I think that reporters are probably, frankly, loath to make too much of it to annoy a press secretary whom they depend upon for information in the days when a press secretary actually had information to push out. And besides, it's such a fine line. What's partisan and what's governmental? When you have an incumbent, it's really hard to make a difference. You know, in my youth, I was a press secretary for a a member of Congress for several years, and we were always very careful to take me off the federal payroll a couple of months at least before the election so that we wouldn't run into that problem. But even so, even when you're on the federal payroll, if you're in these jobs working for politicians, you know that your real job is to get the politician reelected.
Of course, and get yourself paid in the future. You know, in New York State, and I worked for him a long time ago, Fred Ornstein, the minority leader of the New York State Senate, was brought up on charges by, I think, 500 charges by Morgenthau for doing exactly that, using his staff to campaign. And the way that it all ended was that all the other three leaders got up and said, well, if you're going to go after him, you're going to have to go after us, too, because we do it also. And all of a sudden, it went away.
Kaylee is also, from her days at CNN, we know this, like Sarah Huckabee, she's really game to rumble. She is going to go after reporters. She's snarky. She is going to, if she has press conferences, we don't know that yet. We may be in an era where there aren't going to be any more press briefings, a la Stephanie Grisham. But she's not respectful. She does not appreciate the free press. So it's not a good appointment, but then did we really expect one?
Right. So if you're just joining us, folks, this is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. I'm Rex Smith of the Times Union. Alan Shartok, Rosemary Arameo, and Judy Patrick are here. We are giving you some thoughts on media issues of the time. Give us your thoughts, media@wamc.org. media@wamc.org is how you can give us some thoughts on these issues. Here's an interesting question that's raised by a press critic reporting on panic buying. We've certainly seen stories in all the media I could think of about hoarding of face masks, toilet paper, and so on. The question is panic buying coverage itself fueling panic buying, and is that irresponsible on the part of the press?
Which came first, the panic buying or the stories about panic buying?
You know, I do think that the panic buying comes first, but then the press coverage does accelerate it and sensationalize it. I think the initial hoarding is a natural phenomenon of people being scared to death. But I think the images of empty shelves and the repeated coverage of it and not putting it in proper perspective accelerates the problem.
Well, I'm not sure what proper perspective is. I want to read about shortages. I went out this last week to look for a thermometer, and there is not a thermometer to be had in the country.
That's right.
And
me
I
too.
Didn't know that because I hadn't read those stories. I want to know about stuff. And I think there's been some wonderful writing about why you should need more toilet paper now. It's fascinating because basically it's not that people are wiping more. It's where they're wiping. You don't go to work now, so you do need more in your house. And it's not unreasonable to be buying extra. So I think the press has done some fascinating stories about this, and this story about whether we're increasing the panic and sensationalizing is just journalists navel-gazing. Just go write the stories. People are involved in it. It's a story.
You know, I didn't start worrying about it until I saw the stories because I have a reasonable amount of toilet paper in my house. I am not hoarding because I believe in the system. The journalism has told me that the supply chain is fine. We aren't going to run out of toilet paper or any other basic necessities. You know, there may be some problem getting a particular item right here and now, but I think we're getting some context. But those stories didn't come for a few days. Good journalism sometimes takes time. But the initial hoarding stories with the shelves, and we saw shopping carts lined up into Costco's and BJ's wholesale centers, I think that was scary for people.
Well, I'm not sure that the story is that it's easing or true. There's still not toilet paper in any store that I've been to, and I go to a lot of them more than
no.
I should.
I'm not even sure
the reporting is up to date now.
No, we actually have no problem here in Great Barrington. At least I don't. But what is interesting are the changes in the stories about the way that toilet paper has been used historically and what was used before toilet paper. And this has been fascinating about how this whole industry of toilet papery got started.
In Albany, New York, the inventor of toilet paper, as we know it today. It's a wonderful thing.
Well, why would I say I'm surprised?
It's a wonderful, it's a great story. You know, what you need to do if you're writing about panic buying, of course, is be sure that you cover what underlies it. Is toilet paper actually going to run out, or is food actually going to run out? You have to talk to supply chain experts, grocery store owners, and say, look, it's going to be there. The difficulty is that, Rosemary's point is correct. There still is a problem of actually finding some of these products on the shelves, though I'll tell you, it's First time that I've been really glad to be an old guy, because I get to go to the grocery store in that hour between 6 and 7 a.m. reserved for senior citizens and people who are immunocompromised. But you know what's really annoying? I wasn't carded. I showed up at the grocery store at 6 a.m. when they opened up to be able to buy a couple weeks' worth of food and supplies for my household. And they didn't even ask me to show my driver's license to make sure that I'm actually, in fact, a senior citizen. Don't you think that's mean?
No, what are you worried about? You're worried about the fact that people won't know that you're old as you are? Is that what you're telling us? I mean, I don't get that.
I want people to think that I'm younger than, in fact, I am.
Rex, 60? No way. Show me your proof like that.
Yeah, come on. This is.
Yeah, I'm actually worried I don't look old enough to be in there.
Not at all.
I'm worried about it.
No, you don't, Judy. You run 5 miles a day. That's what it's about.
That's the good thing, absolutely. So, in this era when there's this great demand for facts and information and journalism, it comes, of course, at a time when the news media are imperiled in any case by the digital revolution. And we talk about this often on this program, that it's just a shame to see the advertising dollars that have disappeared off the table because they're all going to Google and Facebook in particular in this country. Google and Facebook are sucking up all of the digital ad dollars, leaving none for the news media who have traditionally depended upon that as a revenue source. So people are looking at other models, at philanthropy, at government funding, and paywalls, of course, all of which you're seeing objections to. And so let me get your thoughts about this. The Times Union, like most newspapers, now has a paywall. True also of Judy's paper that she used to edit, the Daily Gazette. But people are very upset when they hit a paywall around coronavirus stories. Many of the news organizations, including ours, have put the coronavirus coverage, or at least some of it, outside the paywall. But then that leads to this question: why should people expect that journalism is going to be free when other products aren't? The food you buy in the supermarket isn't free, but you need that to survive, right? Is that unclear? Is that unfair?
Well, AT&T, for example, right now is giving free business lines, telephone lines, to small businesses in trouble. This is a time for charity and for public service. And newspapers and news outlets have for years said they're more than just a business. They're a public trust. And I think this may be a time, as are times of emergencies during hurricanes, when, you drop the paywall and you don't worry about money for just a little while.
So who pays the journalists?
No one. The journalists are not getting paid. They're being fired in many places, Rex. But
Not my company. That's not a good answer. I mean, how do you keep journalists going if you don't have some revenue coming in? And is 95 cents a week too much to expect people to pay for this information?
I understand. I don't want to get you all irritated again, Rex, because you're closer to this is not a case where some people reading for a few weeks about coronavirus coverage is going to make or break the newspaper. The funding of journalists and payroll is something long term. What you began this segment about, we have to figure out whether it's going to come from government funding or from a different kind of business model that we have yet to discover. It's not because you're letting readers read important stories to their lives in a very short and limited period.
Well, I'm astounded by the fact that, because you guys had it exactly right. You said there's a question of charity, a question of philanthropy. I do know that while we're hearing moans and groans from a lot of the print media, that while we are definitely losing some money at WAMC, there's no question about the fact that we are in terms of our underwriting and other things, but we're doing quite well compared to what I'm hearing these tales of woe about. And I think people are saying, we value this. So therefore, we're going to keep going. We have many, many underwriters who say, okay, we're going to give you the money now and you can use it later if you want to do that. So there are differences in the portals, in the places that are putting out the news.
Yeah.
So for a lot of papers, the question is, you lift the paywall for a certain period of time, but when does that period of time end? And the other problem is, are people will get used to reading news for free? I agree with the need to get essential public information out there and lift the paywall for that. But this is a prolonged pandemic, And are we going to have these paywalls lifted into throughout the summer, into the fall? I mean, that's one of the real issues I think publishers are facing right now.
How about your group, Judy? Judy represents, you know, she's the vice president of this major amalgam of newspapers.
New York Press Association.
New York Press Association. And so are the little papers suffering the most?
Oh, indeed they are, because local businesses are suffering the most. They've been suffering the most all along. A lot of them have healthy local print subscriber base. But as these local restaurants, local businesses are shut down, they're not advertising. And that is incredibly painful for them. And they are faced with, you know, shutting down operations or furloughing and laying people off. So they are trying to figure out ways to keep surviving through this. But a lot of them do have digital sites, and they are lifting the paywall because they feel it's their public responsibility to do so.
So on that point, we're going to have to call it a program. That is
the end
of this week. It's over. Media Project. Alan Shartok, Rosemary Armeo, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith. Thanks again to David Gustina, our producer, and to all of you for joining us this week on the Media Project.
Hold the press, hold the press. Extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. Like the richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ding-a-ling, ding-a-ling, ling-a-ling, ling. Now, newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movie's notwithstanding.
The Media Project is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Alan Shartok is CEO of WAMC, professor emeritus at the State University of New York, commentator, columnist, and author. Rex Smith is editor-at-large of the Times Union. Judy Patrick is the vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association. And Rosemary Armeo is an investigative journalist and former chair of the Department of Journalism at the University at Albany. You can listen to or podcast The Media Project anytime at WAMC.org, or just download the WAMC app for your iPhone or Android at the Play Store today. Thanks for listening.
Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.